Good morning. My name is Kenny. I'm one of the pastors here at Mountain View, and I am a roller coaster enthusiast. Anybody else out there? How many of you guys love roller coasters? All right, turn to your neighbor and tell them why you love them or why you hate them. Ready, go. Why do you love them or why do you hate them? Man, some of you really hate them. This is a long explanation. I mean, wow. Whew. Some of you got some pretty big wounds from a roller coaster somewhere. I don't know what happened, but wow. All right, how many of you got stuck on a roller coaster once? How many of you had like, I think I'm about to fall out of my seat scare? And how many of you had those and still love them? All right, that's my people right there. Okay, so all the people in the front row, of course, you're those people. Yeah, you're the ones that wait the extra 30 minutes to get in the front row of a roller coaster too, right? There you go. See, there it is. See, I knew it. Well, I remember growing up, it was right after we graduated from high school, me and a group of my friends got up. We got on the road by 7 a.m., which if you know anything about high school graduates, that is like ungodly early. But we were on the road. We were headed 3 hours north, what would that be, west, I guess, to a park in Ohio called Cedar Point. Yeah, all right, that's what I'm talking about. All right, it was the premier amusement park, not just of the Midwest, but of the entire U.S. in our case. We had been planning this for multiple months. It was kind of like our, let's do this one last thing as friends in high school, celebrate. It'll be a stake in the ground we can look back to and celebrate for the rest of our lives, remember it. And so we got to the ticket booth right as they opened. We went in, we saw the first ride, we jumped on it, and within a half hour, we had ridden one or two rides. We were excited. 2 hours later, we had gotten through a few more, and it had been about 50% of the time just standing in lines, 50% of the time actually enjoying those rides, right? And so it was early afternoon. We had just gotten through our lunch, and we were waiting for another one of our friends whose gender I will not reveal to you at a bathroom stop. So me and my cousin were sitting outside at a bench waiting yet again for her, stop, and we're having this kind of conversation about how the morning's gone, what we had experienced, and we both kind of related to each other how much of a humdrum kind of experience we had had at that point. It kind of was a letdown almost. We talked about how we had thought we were going to have these jaw-dropping experiences, the amazing thrills that had been promised to us, the stomach-dropping moments, remember those, right? You're at the top of the hill, or the voice-silencing free falls when you start the scream and it stops halfway down the hill because your breath is gone. And we started to bemoan the fact that we hadn't really experienced any of that yet. And so we're like, man, yeah, we gave up so much time. I mean, we drove 3 hours. We were up at 6:30 this morning. We gave up energy and we gave up our money, which is a high school senior, again, is another thing you didn't have much of. And we said at that point, you know what, we're pretty sure we're not going to come again. Like, we're done. We're not coming back to Cedar Point. And we actually started to talk about, you know what, we should probably spend the rest of the day telling everybody why this park is awful. We should actually spend the rest of our lives becoming the biggest enthusiast of turning people away from Cedar Point, because it's awful. It's horrible. And it was because we had these expectations going in, and we were surprised that our expectations weren't met. You ever had a situation like that in life, where an expectation isn't met? Likely it's been in some bigger situation in life, right? Somewhere where you're standing there thinking about it and you're going, it's not supposed to be like this. Life wasn't supposed to be like this. Maybe it's the low hourly rate job you're working when you thought by mid-20s you'd be salary and not living paycheck to paycheck. Maybe it's the breakup you never saw coming, you got blindsided by. Maybe it's that meeting that you walked into thinking you were about to get a job promotion and you walk out unemployed. Possibly it's a health diagnosis in the midst of what's supposed to be your prime years. Or it could even be family dissension when there's supposed to be peace and harmony around your family. But it doesn't have to be the big moments of life either. Think about some smaller moments. It's when you pull out of the drive-thru at a McDonald's and you look in the bag and the order is wrong again. Or maybe you walk in the house and you've reminded your kids over and over again to pick up of themselves and you walk around the corner and what's there again? A massive mess that you've told them over and over. Or maybe you've been planning that time with friends for months and they call you the day of and say, hey, we have to cancel. We can't make it. or reschedule, right? So whether it's an exhilarating day at an amusement park, or maybe it's something serious like a broken relationship you didn't expect, wrecked expectations are not unique to any of us. We've all had some form of wrecked expectation. And they're not even unique to us as 21st century human beings. We're going to meet a couple of people this morning who were going through a deep letdown because of wrecked expectations in their life. They had something in their life they had placed their foundation on, they thought was true, they were living for, they were believing in, and they're living in a moment that we're going to see this morning where it seems like all is undone. They're asking the question, it's not supposed to be this way, is it? They're asking the question, what now? If I can put it this way, I think we're actually going to meet some of the very first deconstructionists in history, if you're familiar with that term. It's the idea of questioning everything, of going back to the foundation of the very things your life is built upon and trying to dismantle or try to understand why you built it upon that. They're reassessing everything they held core and they thought foundational because they had wrecked expectations. Something in life didn't measure up to what it had promised. And so if you turn to Luke chapter 24 with me, or you can open up the Bible app, or if you didn't get that that QR code, it'll be on the screen as well. We're going to jump in and see a couple of people on a road. They're taking a walk, and they're wrestling with wrecked expectations like we do in life. We're going to jump in the middle of the story and then come back and fill it in. Verse 19 of Luke chapter 24. He, being Jesus, said to them, these two people walking, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, a man who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people, how our chief priests and rulers delivered him up to be condemned to death and crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel." Yes, and besides all this, it's now the third day since these things happened. Will you pray with me? God, we come to you as the one who knows each individual in this room. And you know what wrecked expectations we're wrestling with currently in our lives and what we have in the past. So God, I ask that you would speak to us this morning, that you would meet us right now in the midst of those things, however small or large they may be, to help us see and learn from Jesus this morning. It's in your name I pray. Amen. Now, we're going to see these two have wrecked expectations, which we see from verse 21, but it's going to help us see that they actually allow these individuals to have a realigned vision and to be recommissioned. Now, go back up to verse 13, and we find two disciples going away from Jerusalem. Now, you have to remember, what had just happened 3 days earlier for them? Put ourselves back in the story. They're walking away from Jerusalem, and what had just happened in Jerusalem 3 days ago? Jesus was crucified. He had his trial, he was crucified, and he was buried. And it's now Sunday morning, maybe mid-afternoon at the latest. And they're walking away from Jerusalem, 7 miles in the opposite direction of this empty tomb, a place where they had their expectations wrecked. They're talking to each other, right? And this wasn't just a normal talk. This was like deep, disputing, discussing foundational things. I mean, it could be probably a pretty heated personal conversation about what they had experienced. It's not just a run-of-the-mill chat in the park. It's about recent events and discerning what was going on in their lives and what they had just experienced. And that's when Jesus approaches them, but notice that Jesus is not noticed by them. He's a stranger to them. And he comes up and he says, "What is this conversation you're holding with each other?" Now, think about it for a moment. You're walking with a good friend, and you're having this heated conversation about the things you believe and what you've just experienced and sharing your heart with each other and trying to figure it out. And some random stranger comes up and says, "Hey, what are you guys talking about?" Kind of seems intrusive by the stranger, right? And so this is Jesus. He randomly is jumping into a conversation two friends are having about important subjects for both of them. And what do the disciples do? They turn and they stop and they look sad. And so one of them speaks up to Jesus. In verse 18, one of them named Cleopas answered him, says, are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened? It's a bit snarky, isn't it? It's kind of like, duh, come on, guy. Like, don't you read the news? Or any tabloid or anything in our world, right? Haven't you been on Facebook in the last 20 minutes? And Jesus presses into this, though, right? He doesn't take it as this hint, like, okay, these guys don't want me around. He presses in further, and he goes, wait. What news? What things? And so Cleopas and his friend probably do this little side, like, all right, here we go. And they dive into the story. And they say, they're talking about this Jesus of Nazareth, this individual who everybody knew was a prophet, mighty indeed before God and people. They recall his condemnation, his crucifixion, his trial, his burial. And they tell of the women who had gone to the empty tomb. They parlay the angelic visions they had heard about. And even those other two who went to the tomb to check to make sure the women's report was good. And in the midst of that, we still see them sad. Right? They're telling about all they had experienced in the last week, excited about what they had hoped for, how Jesus was that prophet. He had healed people. He'd brought people back from the dead. And their response is to look sad. Why? What made these individuals so sad when Jesus asked the question, what are you talking about? Look at verse 21. What had happened for them? They were sad because what had they hoped? They had hoped he was the one to redeem Israel. In other words, they now had a lost hope. They had a wrecked expectation, just like we do in life. Whether it's a letdown at an amusement park, a broken relationship, job, family, whatever it is, they're sitting in the exact same spot we so often do, questioning the hope they had, what they had anticipated, what they had waited for, what they had been promised, what they longed for, seemed to not come true. And now they're frustrated, and they're confused, and they're reevaluating everything about what they believed. And it's because they thought Jesus was the one who would redeem Israel. Now, what do they mean by that? For the Jewish people, this was the Messiah, the central figure of their entire history. Think back to the beginning of Israel and the beginning of the Jewish people being called out, being made into a nation, then put under slavery by Egypt, and then God delivers them through Moses, through the Red Sea, into the wilderness, provides for them for 40 years, walks them into their land, gives them blessing. They turn to idols and go through this cycle over and over again, where God rescues them and redeems them, and then they turn to idols, and he has to rescue them and redeem, and then they go to idols, and they rescue and redeem. It's their whole history. And they thought for sure that one day there was going to come one who would rescue them for good. When the prophets hit and they're under the Babylonian or the Assyrian empires, the Israel people are saying, there's one coming. Hold on to that hope. There's a redeemer coming. And they believed, who was that redeemer? Sunday school answer, everybody together. Jesus, yes. Right? Why did they think that? Why did they believe that God was going to rescue them through Jesus? Because he had told them so. God had already told them that. Isaiah 59, verse 20. When they were under Babylonian captivity, God spoke to them and said, the Redeemer will come to Zion, Zion being Jerusalem, and redeem his people. Think about their immediate history. When Jesus was coming to earth, right, he had a forerunner named John the Baptist, and his dad, Zechariah, looking at John the Baptist when he's born, says, praise be to God, the God of Israel, because he has come to his people to redeem them. And then you think about Jesus, 8 days old as a baby, in his mom's arms, in the temple, and there's this weird old guy named Simeon and this really strange old woman named Anna who are walking around the temple, and they both see Jesus, and they both begin to tell everybody, it tells us, anyone who is looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem about this child. There was this pent-up anticipation and expectation that Jesus was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And these Jewish disciples had hoped that he would. And now they're walking out of Jerusalem, the place they thought they'd see their hope fulfilled, without hope. Disappointed, dismayed. Because they were told the Redeemer, Jesus, was going to be, was there and was going to redeem them, but he didn't bring redemption. They were told the one who was supposed to rescue them, and they didn't get delivered. They were told the one they should believe in to be set free, and yet they're not emancipated from Roman authorities. See, the truth they looked for, they clung to, and they believed in didn't come through. He died, and he was buried. And their expectations are wrecked at this point. And maybe that's you here this morning. Maybe it's just simply from last week at Easter, when you've been on this spiritual high and you heard of a God who's at his best when he forgives and he restores, and then Monday through Saturday felt like anything but forgiveness and restoration. Or maybe church as a whole, we can feel like that after a packed house and Easter Sunday, and then this week you're stuck with Pastor Kenny. Or there could be larger issues in life for you. Maybe it's a sickness or an illness of yourself or a loved one that seems to have no end in sight. Or it's a broken relationship that seems like it's not going to be healed or mended anytime soon. There are a number of ways and realities in our lives that make us question the promises and reality of what we expect from God and with God. So what are we supposed to do with those unmet expectations? What are we supposed to do to view them? And the reality is, the story goes on, and Jesus teaches us that these wrecked expectations are meant to realign our vision. To realign our vision. Look at verse 25. So they've gone through and told him all who he is. And then Jesus says to them, "O foolish and slow of heart to believe." How compassionate of Jesus. I mean, just think about it. You just told this random stranger you met on a road how your expectations haven't been met and your hope is dismayed and you're downtrodden and you're dismayed and discouraged and you don't know what to do with life. And he looks at you and you expect for him to utter or to do what? Maybe that side hug. Maybe that it'll be all right. Or maybe the church, oh, God's got a plan, right? But what's Jesus do? Hey, fools. Well, thanks. That hits me in the feels, Jesus. Thanks a lot. See, we wouldn't expect that response. But Jesus doesn't just stop and call them foolish ones, which is really talking about their mental capacity, their understanding mentally of something. But he says they're slow of heart to believe. He also talks to their heart here. He says you have a head problem and a heart problem. But he doesn't leave it there. Look at verse 26. He asks them a question. Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things? See, so he doesn't just call them foolish and hard of heart, which most of us would probably want to slap them or hit them and then walk away. When things don't go as we plan, sometimes what we need is not that cushy hug, not that soft, compassionate word. What we need oftentimes is a well-timed question. A needed jolt and reminder to re-examine the situation and our perspective. And that's what Jesus does here. He places just one simple question to jolt them from the quagmire of their despair. In a master teacher kind of way, he leverages one question to open their minds and soften their hearts. You guys ever had a teacher or a mentor or an older person do that for you? When I was in college, I had a dorm director. We had spent 3 years together. It was right after my junior year. I stayed on as staff for the college to do basically all the grunt work that they don't want to pay a normal human being to do. So there was a crew of us that stayed on. We did cafe work. We did lifeguarding. We did just grunt work. We cleaned the dorms. That was fun. And so, but I'd been going through some life stuff and wrestling with what was coming next. You know, you're heading into senior year. You're getting ready for adulting, and we all know how fun that transition is. And wrestling with what was next and some relationship things in my life and what I should do next. And so I went to my dorm director's door, his apartment door, one afternoon. I knocked on the door. He opens the door. He says, "Come on in, Kenny. You want something to drink?" So we got something. We sat down. And I'm going in, and I'm kind of relaying all the things in life. I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do here. And here's this relationship I need some advice on. And here's how I'm seeing things. And this person did that. And, man, I just don't know what to do. I'm just kind of lost for anything. And my hope in that point was probably, if you've ever had those kind of conversations, you hope they're going to have what? Some answer, some nugget of gold, right? Like, oh, you're going to drop this, like, mic drop moment, and I'm going to be like, oh, yeah, all right, now I know what to do. But all he did was he turned to me, and guess what he asked? he asked me a well-placed question, and he goes, why do you think those things are like that? Why are you responding that way? What is that showing you you're believing, or you're loving, or you're thinking? And we went on for a half hour, an hour, having this conversation back and forth. And as I walked out, I just thought, I was like, you know what? I think he said one sentence of statements in that whole hour. But he asked these questions. But I walked out with a new perspective and a greater clarity of what was next. And if any of you are teachers, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Parents, sometimes we get that joy. Jesus asked this question to invite these disciples to reconsider their expectations, to invite them to a moment of instruction. See, he wanted to realign what they believed to be true, to realign their expectations. Because Jesus' point was they had wrecked expectations that were built upon a faulty premise. They had missed something. And that something, he says, was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer? See, these two disciples had a false belief that the Messiah was never going to suffer, that he was simply going to come and conquer and rule and reign. And that feeling of hopelessness was not based on that reality. It was based on a limited understanding. You see, they had not believed everything they should have. And Jesus makes that clear. He calls them foolish ones, slow of heart to believe what? What was it they missed believing? There's an important word that comes right after that. They missed believing all that the prophets had spoken. They see, they had cut and pasted parts of the scriptures together. They looked back to their Old Testament story. They looked back to the narrative of their history and picked out the parts and came up with a Messiah, but it wasn't the Messiah God actually sent. See, here's the truth that Jesus is revealing to them. A partial truth is dangerous. Having just part of the story can be deadly. Dan Kimball talks about this in a book I just recently finished reading called How Not to Read Your Bible. He talks about so many different things that people can read from the Bible. Like, did you know there's unicorns in it? Or did you know that people believe that God hates babies because he wants them dashed upon the rocks? Or that this Messiah that's supposed to come is just supposed to rule and reign and set everything perfectly right now? And Kimball uses those different illustrations, oftentimes arguments from those who discount the Bible or discredit Christianity, to make one of his major points, and it's this: partial truths are harmful. And so how do we correct that? Well, here's what he says. He says, when we are trying to make sense of disturbing or crazy-sounding Bible verses, one of the most helpful phrases we can keep in mind is, never read a Bible verse. And that's what the disciples had missed. They had read Bible verses they had wanted. They had plucked what they wanted out. And so Jesus comes in with those wrecked expectations they have, wrestling with what they believe, to say, let me help fill in the gaps to correct your vision. And then we get this beautiful line from Jesus next, or from Luke in verse 27. So what does Jesus do to realign? What does he do to fill in the gaps? What does he do to help them see they just missed it? Verse 27, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them in all the scriptures the things concerning himself. The things concerning himself. In other words, Jesus went back to the beginning of the story, and guess what he did? He retold the story as it's meant to be read. Now, what would he have done? How would he have done that to show them that this Messiah, this king, this reign was supposed to be suffering first, that he would sacrifice first? I don't know where he would have gone. Man, I would have loved to be on that road to hear that. Jesus walked through the Old Testament, the story. Here's some places I think he might have gone. First, Genesis 3, verse 15. Right, just after Adam and Eve had fallen, and Jesus is talking to the serpent, and he says, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and her offspring. He shall bruise your head, but you shall bruise his heel. Guess what? If a serpent bites your heel, that is a wound. It's suffering. He may have stopped at Leviticus 16. Now, in the Jewish context, they had to do sacrifices for sins. And in Leviticus 16, it talks about the Day of Atonement, where the high priest would take two goats, two sacrifices, and one he would kill and pour out the blood for the people as an offering for their sin. And the other he would place symbolically all the sins of Israel in the last year on that goat, and he'd release it into the wilderness so the sins would be away from the people. A suffering goat, a forgotten, rejected lamb. He may have fast-forwarded to Psalm chapter 22, and I'm just going to read it. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me from the words of my groaning? Oh my God, I cry by day, but you do not answer, by night, but I find no rest. I'm a worm, I'm not a man, scorned by mankind, despised by the people. All who see me mock me. They make mouths at me, they wag their heads. He trusts in the Lord, let him deliver him. Let him rescue him, for he delights in him. And then he definitely would have gone forward to Isaiah chapter 53, where Isaiah is telling his people, still in captivity to Babylon, that there's this coming Messiah, and in the midst of that explanation of this Messiah, he goes, he was pierced for our transgressions, crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. He was oppressed, he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people. He may have finished in Zechariah 12, at the very end of the Old Testament, where God says, I'll pour out on all the house of David and the inhabitants of Jerusalem a spirit of grace and plea for mercy, so that when they look on me, on him whom they have pierced, they shall mourn for him, as one mourns for an only child and weeps bitterly over him, as one weeps over a firstborn. See, here's the thing. The disciples missed it because they weren't looking for it. God hadn't hidden it for them. It was all throughout the story. All throughout the Old Testament, God foretold a Messiah that would come and suffer, be beaten, and rejected. So how could they miss it? How did those two disciples miss it? Because they focused only on the glory, on the victory, on the comfort for them. But Jesus reminds them that there's suffering before saving, there's rejection before redemption, and there's adversity before glory. But how often are we exactly like these disciples? And let me just speak from my own heart. How often do I not recognize Jesus is with me because I have a faulty view of who he is and what he should be doing? Maybe you're here as someone who's still uncertain of who Jesus is, still not willing to claim that he's more than just a moral teacher or a good example. But can I challenge you to consider all that the Bible says about Jesus? All of it? That yes, he is a great teacher, that he's a great moral example, but that he's a God who became man, that he lived a perfect life, that he suffered and bled and died for my sin and for your sin, and that he rose again to offer forgiveness and salvation and to restore us, to reinstate us to his family. But follower of Jesus, Christian, maybe you're here, and how often is true for us? We don't recognize Jesus because of our faulty expectations of him. We enter into some form of suffering or hardship, and the first thing we do is, where's God in this? Our expectations of how school or life or work or marriage or parenting or even church and our relationship with God itself go unmet, and so we quickly go, I'm done. Can I challenge all of us, myself first most, to say maybe it's not Jesus at all, but maybe it's our false understanding of Jesus that causes that heartache? Maybe we need, like these disciples, a bit of a realignment, a reorienting of the story of who our God is. Could it be that we, like these disciples, want the crown without the cross? That we want the glory without the adversity? We want the saving work of Jesus without the suffering of it? So the question is, where does our vision and our picture and our understanding of Jesus need realigned this morning? But the story doesn't end here. They were wrecked expectations, Jesus realigns their vision. But here's the thing. They still haven't recognized Jesus. Isn't that kind of odd? I mean, he just spent like who knows how long, probably a couple hours explaining to them who he is, like through the whole Old Testament. They spent 3 years of his life, of their lives with him, and they still don't recognize him? Why is that? Because Jesus still had to recommission them. Look at verse 32. What happens next? They come off the road, they invite Jesus in, and they sit down. And they have this meal, and then after the meal, their eyes are open. In verse 32, they said to each other, "Did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened to us the scriptures?" Jesus opened God's word. He pointed them back to the Bible, not just to read it, but to explain what it meant. And as he did, their hearts began to burn. Their emotions began to emerge and to heighten as they listened to Jesus tell all those stories of this Messiah, of what he was to do, the story of all stories, and their hearts awaken, they connect, and they resonate with this narrative, with this story that Jesus is telling, and they get excited and animated and joy-filled, and they start seeing themselves as part of this story. Have you ever done that with a good book? Or maybe a movie? Right? Every good movie you start to watch, one of my favorites, probably my favorite still, is Cinderella Man. It's a story of a down-and-out boxer. He was at the top of his game. He broke his hand at the same time the Great Depression begins. And as he breaks his hand, he obviously can't fight. He doesn't make income, and they're heading into the Great Depression, and so he begins to lose the ability to care for his family. The utilities come, and they shut off the utilities one day in the middle of winter, and they're sitting there, and his kids are in bed and freezing and cold breath coming out, and you see the smoke. And he goes down to the docks to try to get any work he can, but he rarely gets hired because of the broken hand. And they get to the point where they're not even able to feed their children. And they're contemplating and having a deep discussion, he and his wife, about sending the kids off where somewhere they could be cared for and loved. And it's at that moment that my heart as a father breaks. And you see yourself like, man. But he begins, his hand heals, and he gets that fight. His trainer comes and says, "Hey, I got to fight." And so he gets this like back alley fight to get back on the ring. And he works his way up to the greatest boxer of the time and Max Baer. But here's the problem. Max Baer has killed multiple people in the ring. And so you get to the end of the story and he's in the ring and he's fighting Max Baer. And there's this dramatic effect where you see and your heart is aligned with his and you're rooting for him and hoping that it comes. And you'll have to watch the movie to see how it ends. But doesn't your heart do the very same thing when you hear a good story or watch a movie? Your emotions are engaged. You see yourself as part of the story. It's because our emotions respond to story like water on a hot skillet. It makes them explode with fervor that's a story we can see ourselves a part of. And it's because we're storied creatures. Did you know this? We are storied creatures. John York says this about storytelling in his article in The Atlantic. Storytelling has a shape. It dominates the way all stories are told and can be traced back not just to the Renaissance, but to the very beginnings of the recorded word. All stories are forged from the same template. We are storied creatures trying to find the story to place ourselves into. And the template that John York, not a believer, but studied stories of all times for multiple months and years, says there's a template that all stories are tied to. And that template is what Jesus was communicating to the disciples. The story of perfection as all things are as they should be, harmony and peace in relationships and in the world. Followed by heartache and a fall and sin and death and destruction and chaos taking over. But then in the end, peace and harmony being restored. That's the story of all stories that the disciples believed before Jesus was with them. But the piece of the story they missed was that the Creator God stepped into creation not simply to come and set things right immediately, but to first take on the sinful brokenness of the creation, of us as the creatures. To recreate, to set things right one day, what caused these disciples and should cause our hearts to burn within us. But it also responded in them physically responding. It wasn't just that they said, "Hey, cool story, bro." what an emotional, spiritual experience that was to hear Jesus tell those stories. No, see, the understanding of the story helped them understand their part in the story. Let me say that again. The understanding of the story helped them understand their part in the story. And so what did they do? Look at verse 33. They got off their butts and they rose and they returned to Jerusalem and they found their fellow dismayed followers of Jesus, their faith community that walked for 3.5 years believing that he was the one they could place their faith and trust in and build their life upon. And they began to encourage one another. They began to retell that story once again. They did what the author of Hebrews tells us to do, to not forsake the meeting together, to consider how we can spur one another up to love and good works. And they told others. They told their story, verse 35. They told what had happened on the road. They just simply told their story as part of a larger story. See, we all have wrecked expectations that are meant to realign our vision and result in us being recommissioned. And it's that wrecked expectation that one day, as I sat on a bench in the middle of Cedar Point, that actually caused me to be an ardent supporter and promoter of that theme park. Because as we were sitting there kind of complaining, another friend came up and said, "Guys, wait a second, you missed it. We just went through the opening corridor of the park. There's so much more to come." And we went through the rest of that day, and I can tell you today, I still think Cedar Point is the best amusement park on the planet. Prove me wrong. But the same is true for many other areas of my life. The things that I'm most passionate about come from some of the biggest discouragements and frustrations and wrecked expectations of my past. And maybe the same is true for you. Maybe you're currently in a wrecked expectation that God is going to use to realign your vision and recommission you to use that to tell the greatest story ever. Maybe you're passionate about learning because your experience was anything but good. And maybe you just realize that learning takes more than one form. Maybe you're passionate about marriage because there was a day when you almost or someone else almost walked out, but there was someone who came alongside you and reoriented your vision to see what it could be. And now you can't imagine life any other way. Or maybe it's the health issue that almost rotted your soul as it destroyed your body. But a renewed vision of suffering has invigorated your drive for life despite the difficulty. Maybe you're here and it's actually wrecked expectations you have with God or the church or religion in general. Let me challenge you to read this story again this week and look at these disciples as living examples that Jesus challenges to dive into his word, to review the story, and to lean into the community, the people around you right now, to your left and to your right, in front of you and behind you. And maybe after all that, maybe you're like me and you just wish there was some tangible physical way to see Jesus. That you're like, "Man, I look through scripture, I see it, it's great, but I just wish I could see him. To know he suffered, to observe his sacrifice for you and for me." Well, as the worship team comes up to close us, I want us to look back at verse 30, because Jesus did that for us. They're going along, and they get Jesus to come in with them. And when he was at the table with them, what does he do? He took the bread and he blessed it and broke it and he gave it to them. And it's when they break the bread together, what happens? Their eyes are what? Opened. Jesus gave them a physical example of his sacrifice in the bread and in the wine or juice. They're reliving an earlier practice. And so as our ushers go around and hand out a communion cup, let me just explain, let me remind us. Jesus was giving them a physical reminder of who he was. He didn't give them a crown. He didn't give them jewels. He didn't give them riches. He didn't give them the comfy blanket. To open their eyes to see Jesus for who he was, he gave them bread and wine. To observe the hinge point and the revealing part of who Jesus really is. The one who sacrificed his body and shed his blood so that we could have a hope. It's the way we as followers of Jesus, we're about to practice communion together. It's the way we as followers of Jesus, any follower of Jesus, has an opportunity to realign our expectations every time we come to the bread and the cup. To be recommissioned regularly, to remind ourselves that our sin has been covered. It's been forgiven, it's been dealt with. The brokenness we experienced in the last week will one day be set right. But that day is not yet. But the good news is we don't have to pay or work for our redemption. But we get to work from our redemption. So if you're here and you're unsure, if maybe you've never done this or this is your first time at church going through, let me just remind you, if you don't know and see Jesus, thanks Jeff, as the forgiver of your sins and leader of your life, you can do that today by placing your faith and trust in him. By seeing that there is one who is laid on a cross, who took your sin on his body, shed his blood to cover it, took it to the grave and bore your death that we deserve for our sin, and he rose again offering us life. But Christian, don't forget that the one we look forward to enjoying life with forever and the celebration and all things being set right came to suffer, offer his body and his blood for us. So as we each have a piece of bread and a cup of juice, here's what I want us to do as the worship team plays and sings. You can sing along, just reflect on the words and on the suffering and crucifixion of Jesus and our risen Savior. I want us to take our wrecked expectations to Jesus this morning. Take that situation of life where you're going, what now? Whether it's a relationship or a job, whatever it may be. Will you ask Jesus this morning to realign your vision and understanding of his story of suffering and salvation? After a few minutes, I'm going to come back up. We'll eat and drink together. Just follow as I do it. And we're going to stand and worship. So take the bread and juice, reflect, and spend some time taking your wrecked expectations to Jesus and asking him to realign them as the worship team leads us together.
Caught up in your presence.